on this very stacked episode of Baseball Barbacast, we talk about the Pontiff loving ball. We talk about Rafi Devers saying no gracias first base. We talk about the Pirates axing their skipper, Derek Shelton, and we get maybe too ugly. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that can't wait for those Vatican City Connects. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And all of religious history has led up to this. Yes, my dear friends, the Pope is a White Sox fan.
Oh my goodness, Jake Mintz. I haven't been this excited to podcast in a long time. One of the best parts about this job is when something happens in the baseball world or the baseball adjacent world, and we know that very soon we get to talk into microphones about it. And in particular, when we get news on a Thursday that builds up to a Friday episode like this, there just isn't a better feeling. And I gotta be honest, you know, yesterday morning we get this news. Oh, Derek Shelton was fired. Oh no, we're gonna have to talk about the Pirates to open Friday's show. And you know, had that happened and they selected some random dude from Italy to be the Pope, and had Rafael Devers said, yeah, I'll play first base, I would have been like, all right, Friday sure. Episode, here we go, let's do it, we'll do our best, we'll have a good time, but it won't be anything special. Instead, over the remainder of Thursday, we were gifted so much incredible stuff to talk about. Ugh. And now here we are. And now, Jake, I'm so excited to say this. What do we start the podcast with, right? What do we start with? It's
the opener.
It's the opener, but not today. It's the Popener.
Luis Robert Prevost is your new Pope. Pope Leo, let me read these Roman numerals right quick. The 14th. 1-4. We're Jewish, so religiously, this means nothing to us. But in terms of the baseball, which I guess is our real religion, it means a great, great deal. Pope Leo the 14th is the first American Pope. He is the first Pope to rock the stars and stripes. He is the first Pope that rooted for Trey Turner and the WBC. He is the first Pope that has presumably, you know, like maybe even been up the Sears Tower. He is from Chicago. And when we found out that this Pope was bleeding red, white, and blue and was from Chicago, I mean, my brain immediately went to, I mean, Sox or Cubs. And before we had any, you know, news about Sox or Cubs, I tweeted out Sox or Cubs. Millions of other people, I'm sure, tweeted out Sox or Cubs. And there could have been a world in which he was from Chicago and didn't give two craps about ball. Okay? And that is not what happened.
No. And the fact that that question of Sox or Cubs ended up turning into what it was yesterday, which was some initial reporting that it was Cubs. Again, because you get an American Pope, and I imagine, oh, we were watching all these different American news outlets, and it's like, oh my God, like it's our guy. That's he's an American. Like, what can we tell you about him? Because, with all due respect to the past popes from Poland and Germany and Argentina, it's like, yeah, this is sort of what we know. And then you probably kind of move on to the other news related to American affairs. But in this case,
you're like, the Pope likes Boca Juniors, or you know,
right,
going for
but
walks.
In this case. In this case, it's like, oh my God, he's just from Chicago. Like, let's go talk to his family and all these people that know him and ask the questions like Sox or Cubs. And somehow, initially, it was reported that he was a Cubs fan. So much so that the Cubs Twitter account itself posted a photo with what I assume is Photoshop, but maybe did we think they actually put this on the Jumbotron outside Wrigley Field?
Yes, they put this on the sign outside Wrigley Field, the famous Wrigley Field, home of Chicago Cubs sign, which, by the way, it's not home of the Chicago Cubs. It's home of Chicago Cubs. I've never thought about that. And it says, "Hey, Chicago, he's a Cubs fan!" Exclamation point. They tweeted it out. Congratulations to Pope Leo XIV. Okay. Flag in the sand.
That's at 4:14 p.m. Okay. At least what I'm seeing on as the timestamp on Twitter.
And then at 4:45 p.m., Josh Friedman, the truth emerges. Sports anchor and reporter at WGN News comes out with the truth. And he says, obviously, the biggest question surrounding Chicago native Big Bob Prevost, now that he's Pope Leo 1-4, Cubs or White Sox, his brother gave the definitive answer, which is perfect tweet because then you got to watch the video, right? But before you even watch the video, you take a look at this brother. He's wearing a nice little flannel. And what color is that flannel? Black, gray, and white, not red, white, and blue. Sox over Cubs. Let's go. Yes.
And what is so amazing is not just that, oh, yeah, he's not just like, yeah, he liked the White Sox, and then they move on. He's like, yeah, I don't know where all this Cubs stuff is coming from. He's always been a White Sox fan. Now, he does mention a little interesting nugget and perhaps an explanation of the confusion. He mentioned in this interview and another interview that I saw that his mother and that side of the family were Northsiders, as they say, was a Cubs fan. However, their father was, hilariously, a Cardinals fan. Oh, well, we know he followed that in some respects, becoming a Cardinal, but no.
His dad was a Cardinals fan. His dad was a Cardinals fan, and now the Cardinals are his fans.
Nicely done. But understanding he grew up on the North side, grew up on the South side, even though his mother was a Cubs fan, his dad was a Cardinals fan. He was a White Sox fan, and his brother's like, yeah, he's a White Sox fan. Like, this isn't even a question. And then, so that's already compelling, right? You're hearing from the family, and you're
point, I believe we get a tweet from the White Sox, the worst team of all time last year. Okay.
Definitely not this year. Only normal bad this year.
This comes in at 6:23 p.m. It says, well, would you look at that? Congratulations to Chicago's own Pope Leo.
And then.
14th. With the video of the brother. Okay.
Yes, video of the brother, same interview. And then the Chicago Sun-Times drops the absolute hammer. They get an interview with a family and a community in Chicago that has known Big Bob Prevost for a while. And this is a Catholic school that was connected and knew him and were so excited to find out that he was
the Pope,
you know, that he was the Pope, because obviously, duh. Oh, how's Bob? What's Bob up to? Oh, he's the Pope now. Oh, cool.
It's the Pope.
They have this photo in this story of Mr. Pope, Sir Pope himself, at the 2005 World Series. Yes, the Chicago White Sox, who ended a very, 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 very long drought and won the World Series in 2005 against the Astros, sweeping the Houston Astros. There is a photo of this man at the game on what looks to be like a Nokia cell phone, making calls, telling everybody how awesome Paul Konerko is. And that's it. That seals the deal. It's over. This man is not just, you know, grew up and thought Louis Aparicio was cool. This guy has been into the Sox for a long time. Now, has this enough fandom extended?
Yeah. Like going to a World Series game. As a fan, is an expensive thing to do, first of all. Okay. But a committed move. This is not someone who went to a couple ball games. Like, this is someone who had opinions on Mark Burley, right?
Had to have.
Yep. Now he's the Pope.
Yep. It's that simple. And the obvious question now is, how has his Sox fandom manifested over the last 20 years? And hopefully we will start to learn that more in the coming weeks and months. Not that that is the most important thing he has to deal with right now, but hopefully at some point when he makes his way back to Chicago,
we can get a little bit more clarity about the degree to which he has followed these Sox as they have fallen from the mountaintop of World Series champs in 2005 to the absolute bottom of the sport in 2024 to now a new chapter of hope, courtesy of Pope, courtesy of Will Venable and Chase Mydroth and Edgar Caro and Braden Montgomery and everyone else who plays for the Kannapolis Cannonballers. Shout out. Where does this go from here? I don't really care because I've already feel so lucky to have experienced this day on the internet. But this is just a great story. And I can't believe that this is how it worked. And I'm so happy for White Sox fans because the Cubs didn't need the Cubs player. Correct. Great. What do they need the Pope for right now? Come on.
I couldn't agree more. Like, the Cubs fans don't need PCA and the Pope. They don't need Pope and Pope Crow Armstrong at the same time. They are a fan base in relative wealth and health, whereas the White Sox are what you would call a poverty franchise. And what is the Pope supposed to do if not take care of the poor?
Yeah, the needy, right? Stand up for those in need and understand, right? I think that's really what it is to have the ability to, as if, again, what do we know anything about what the Pope is supposed to do? So I apologize for speaking on this behalf. But for the purposes of this baseball conversation, that is how we are going to apply it. This is it. It's inspiring. And honestly, it's the start of a great story. If the White Sox, along with his guidance, whether or not he's watching anymore, I think that's great. I think that it's a perfect story that we can now watch this team rise, you know, with the help of, some divine intervention is maybe a little strong, but some divine influence.
Yeah. So we got a great email from Jimmy, who appears to be a White Sox fan and went to Catholic school. And it's a great email. I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but there's a line that really stood out to me. I just want to hop in on that. He says, when speaking definitively on matters of faith, the Pope is free from error. God's words, not mine. And baseball fandom is nothing but faith. So the fact that he cannot be wrong when proclaiming things about the White Sox has to be one of the biggest gets for Chris Getz and his squad. And this is the thing. Never in the history of the world has someone so definitively known ball. He has to know ball. Whatever the Pope says regarding ball is the truth. If the Pope says they should move Braden Montgomery back to the mound where he pitched in college, Chris Getz has to do it because Pope, the rule one, the Pope is right. Rule two, check rule one. Okay.
If he decides Luis Robert is going to be on the next good White Sox team, we are not trading this man. He's going to stick out the rest of this contract and we are going to pay him next year and the year after that. And by then the White Sox will be good. So be it. That's how it's going to be.
Was the previous Pope, the Argentina Pope, a soccer fan?
I don't know.
He was. That's okay. So
yeah, I mean, it seems likely.
Here we go. Jorge Bergoglio was member 88235 of his beloved San Lorenzo soccer club.
All right. Okay.
So did he ever share takes about San Lorenzo? That's the thing.
This is a great question.
I have to do more research. If there's like him saying that they need a new right back, then it's clear that the Pope is comfortable to speak on specific matters of roster construction. That would be amazing and tells me that the Pope could give us
to that point, right? It makes me think about, okay, so because part of this process is like, how does the Pope feel about X? Right. That's kind of the discussions leading up to finding out who the Pope's going to be. Oh, how does the Pope feel about this? This is a big issue. This is going to be a big deal, whether he feels this way about this. This will influence a lot of people in these certain countries and these certain. So what are those issues with the White Sox right now? I think it's
Like if the Pope, comes out here and is like, I don't want robo umps. Does that move the needle for when we get robo umps? It's a good question.
But again, it's not zero. Let's keep it focused on the White Sox. Like, what are those issues right now? I think it's probably like, should Tim Elko be in the big leagues right now? Right.
Yes.
What more does he need to do in AAA? Is he really learning anything? Does he really have to cut down the swing and miss? He's gotten 1,000 OPS. He's 26 years old. Like, should Tim Elko be in the big leagues? Is it, you mentioned Brandon Montgomery development. You mentioned, should Chase Mydrop be playing second or short? Should you trade Luis Robert? Is this coaching staff going to be the one to lead the next good White Sox team? Or is it, you know, more of a transition period?
The war in Ukraine.
The war in Ukraine, for sure. That's also something that I think is on Chris Getz's mind over the next year or so, I have to imagine.
What does the Pope think?
What does the Pope think? Right. You know, he can mix that into his opinions about Tim Elko. I mean, listen, there's a lot of things. But point is, I don't know when we're going to get further context on this, but I am certainly compelled.
I'll finish with this. Josh Friedman, however you say it, please let us know, because, I mean, he is the Bob Woodward of Sox Pope. He tweets this: White Sox statement to WGM.
Oh, yes, this is important. This is very important, yes.
On Pope Leo XIV Sox side allegiance, they have a Sox jersey on its way to the Vatican. The statement says, family always knows best, and it sounds like Pope Leo XIV's lifelong fandom falls a little closer to 35th and Shields, which is where their mediocre stadium is located. Some things are bigger than baseball, and in this case, we're glad to have a White Sox fan represented at the Vatican. A pinstripe White Sox jersey with his name on it and a hat are already on their way to Rome. And of course, the pontiff is always welcome at his ballpark.
So many parts of this. Sorry. Yeah, we have many parts of this quote we need to stay.
I want
to
start at the
review.
End. Yes. So my one edit would be, the pontiff is always welcome at his ballpark. We got to change ballpark to cathedral. Like, that's just a layup, right?
Sure.
In my opinion.
But also that it's his.
It's his. This is the most other-centered thing Sox owner Jerry Reinsdorf has ever done.
I think, okay, two other things I want to get at.
What does the Pope think about the City Connects? Thank God that I didn't send him a City Connect.
Well, so I did have that question. What jersey exactly are we sending him? That is definitely an important question.
And what does it say on the back? It says with his name on it. Does it say,
Does it just say Pope? Prevost?
And you know what it probably says? Leo 14 is the number.
Has to be, right? But then this gets to my question about the jersey and the hat, which is, what is he more likely to wear? Because realistically, the Pope is essentially always in pretty elaborate garments, you know? And I don't know which of these items he's more likely to wear in public. Like, if we're going to see the Pope, you know, repping some White Sox stuff, would he really wear a hat? I don't know. It just seems, or a jersey over the robes. I don't know. Which is more likely, do you think?
So I'm now looking into the previous Pope.
Yeah.
And it appears that there are photos of him holding up the jersey of San Lorenzo Almagro.
Yep.
Okay. When was Pope Francis started to Pope? So I don't know if there are any pictures of Pope Francis holding the jersey post popage.
There is
a photo of him holding a jersey at what seems to be a rally. There's a photo of him holding a scarf. There's a photo of him being handed. This is amazing. Him holding a jersey of Campeón Copa Libertadores 2014. So I don't think he's going to wear anything. I don't think he will don the cap. I don't think he will hold up he will wear the jersey. However,
I agree.
I do believe that we will see him in some way,
acknowledging
White Sox
something
stuff.
White Sox. Okay.
And
I think
this brings up a thought in my mind. So the White Sox can send something to the Vatican for the Pope, right? Number one, where did they get the address?
Presumably they have some sort of P.O. box. I don't know how mail works in the
There's a P.O. box that you can just send stuff to the Pope. And it makes sense to me that the White Sox would get to the front of the line. But if the Pope was a reportedly a Kannapolis Cannonballers fan. Like, obviously, yeah, the minor league team would send the Pope swag, but would they jump the line? Like, there's
more,
so much
more
stuff.
Likely to send swag, right?
Right. There's so much stuff going to the Pope. How is it? Might take years for the Sox stuff to get to the Pope.
Sure, sure. I think these are all fair questions, fair concerns. I have to imagine there's going to be a lot of adjustments to having, you know, an American Pope. I mean, he might be, you know, trying to DoorDash Chipotle to the Vatican, you know, he might be, or I don't know, give me a Chicago version of some food from Chicago that
Portillo's,
he'd be trying to
dude.
Get. Okay. Portillo's. There you go. Like maybe there's going to be a lot of adjustments, I'm sure, to the kinds of stuff that is being brought to the Vatican. Anyway, my last point. So, okay. So that was the one thing. Well, two more things. Then we can take a break.
We can leave.
So the first thing is, the other obvious point is just, I mean, first pitch, right? So that's the real dream.
Yeah.
Presumably, again, when you're the Pope, you're all around the world. I have to imagine he will make an appearance back in Chicago at some point soon.
It's a lock. It's a lock. He'll be in Chicago. It's a lock.
For sure. But is he going to throw out a first pitch? Is that not considered like, is that below the Pope? Even if he gets the, like, it feels like it would be. It feels like it's kind of, yes, below the Pope, even if he deep down is like, oh, I really want to do it. You know, I don't know how much leeway he has to kind of see out that dream. I'm sure his new responsibilities will kind of override that. I think he can I'm sure he'll kind of have some feel there. But my favorite part about this statement is just, some things are bigger than baseball. That just, something about that just kills me, because it's like, yeah, no, I would say that the Pope, the only job currently that we have that stretches all the way back to a lineage back to, thousands and thousands of years. Yeah, I would say that is bigger than baseball. But thank you for clarifying in this White Sox statement.
A previous Pope did not attend a San Lorenzo match during the papacy.
Okay. So that's the thing. But again,
it's hard
maybe
to believe.
Maybe we're in a new era.
Look,
and
if
maybe
the,
he will say yes.
If the Yankees and Red Sox can play in London, the White Sox and Cubs can play in Rome.
But the other question is, like, if the White Sox were good, would it make it more likely?
No.
You know, because he's not. Okay. Not if they get back to the World Series 20 years after he was there. It just feels like, you know, maybe. Well, we'd really be testing his fandom. Testing his faith. All right.
Great job. Great job.
That's it.
Great
Thank
job,
you. There
everyone.
Was our there's our popener.
I've never felt more connected to my Catholic faith is at an all-time high.
That's true. There we go.
And to the Catholics
you have more
out
thoughts?
There. To the, yeah, Catholics out there who are riding with this guy legit, like a couple friends of ours, got a lot of texts yesterday. I got a text, by the way, from a very good friend of ours when it came out that the Pope was a Cubs fan at first.
Oh, the first, yeah.
And she texted me, no chance. She was like, no chance. He's a White Sox fan. There's no way he's a Cubs fan. And I was like, damn. Catholic ball fans knew. They knew.
They knew. It's only right. So if you have more White Sox Pope thoughts, let us know. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. But for now, we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, special guest, it's Ryan Spielborgs. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now very excited to welcome in one of our good friends in this here baseball media industry. You can see him on Apple TV Plus's Friday Night Baseball. He played baseball for the Colorado Rockies for quite some time, and he is our friend. His name is Ryan Spielborgs. Spilly, welcome to Baseball Barbacast.
Hi, guys. Yeah, sorry I don't have my makeup on. A little bit of a red-eye flight last night, which I always wonder, what is the etiquette on sleeping on flights? If the person is on the aisle,
yeah,
are they allowed to just pass out, stretch out? Because what happens if you have to go in the window? I'm asking for a friend. If you're on the window and you need to go to the bathroom at some point because it's a 4-hour flight.
Okay, this is probably where it matters, right? There's probably a level where it's like, if it's an hour and a half flight, go ahead, pass out in the aisle. No one's going to stop you. You can deal with it. You can hold it in. 4 hours is probably pushing where you're maybe being a little bit disrespectful.
Disagree.
To your fellow
Disagree.
Humans.
If you are a plane peer, it's a skill issue. get on the seat chart the early. Bathroom. Go to the bathroom early. Get that's a you problem. Sorry. Don't like it. Pitch better.
Don't like it. Pee earlier, I think is the takeaway.
All right. All right. So I guess, okay. I held it for 4 hours because that person wasn't moving. So.
Oh, okay. So Billy, I was going to say you can let your friend know that's James. Since it obviously is not something that just happened to you. Okay.
Now we're not going to talk about plane etiquette, but we are going to talk about etiquette on this segment here with Ryan Spielborgs as the biggest news in the baseball world, sans Pope yesterday, was that Rafael Devers spoke to the media and said, no, thank you. I do not want to play first base. Now, the chain of events here is important, and I will review them quickly for everybody. The Red Sox signed Alex Bregman over the winter to play third base because they want Christian Campbell to be the everyday second baseman. That means Rafael Devers, who signed a $313 million extension a number of years ago, was out of a position. LOL JK, he's going to go DH. Originally, Devers was iffy about moving DH. Eventually, he agreed to do it. He moves to DH. He starts hitting well. Everything is good. Tristan Casas, who's playing first base, is not hitting well. Then, boom, blows his leg out on a play. He's out for the season, and the Red Sox have been playing Abraham Toro at first base while Devers DHs and a number of top prospects wallow in AAA, asked to move to first base, which would open up things positionally for the Red Sox. Devers has said no. Yesterday, he spoke to the media about it and offered a bunch of very bizarre revealing quotes that showcased some disgruntlement between he and the organization. That is your TLDR. I will now kick it to you, Spilly. What do you make of this entire situation?
It was preventable. I think there's a lot of things here. First off, you know, let's start with communication. I think this was really poorly communicated from the front office to Devers to begin with. There was no question, right? Like, if it was me trying to talk to a player, and we'll get into the separation, why I think there was some communication breakdown here. For a player like Devers, where the metrics defensively, there's no argument. You cannot argue that you're a plus defender. You're not. He's the bottom of baseball at third base in outs above average, defensive runs saved, every single defensive metric, the eye test, like everything. There isn't one that says, you know what, you should continue to play third base. It shouldn't be the issue. Now, Rafi said in the offseason, well, Heim Bloom told me I was going to play third base the whole time of the contract. Well, Heim Bloom is in St. Louis. Heim Bloom isn't with the Red Sox anymore. Heim Bloom is gone. And so this to me was a front office that didn't tell him early, right? It should have been at the end of the year when the season was over, before Alex Bregman rumors, before anything. Rafi, we want you to train this offseason, working at first base. We want you to be a little bit more mobile here. This is where we want you to grow comfortable. We understand we have Tristan Casas here too, but you have a massive contract. We want you to be able to have this in your bag so that if it happens, it happens. And we want you to be involved with it. That's usually what you ask a player to do when it's a positional change. The problem that you have, and I don't know all the machinations of this, but I've talked about it on MLB Network Radio a bunch. You know, Craig Breslow is a pitcher. A pitcher versus a position player, two separate animals. I even joke around, pitchers don't even play baseball. Like, they really don't actually play the game. They pitch.
They pitch.
They throw the ball for the game.
So, this is why of the 30 MLB managers right now, there is one pitcher and 29 former position players. Being a pitcher gives you a different perspective on the entire sport. Sorry, continue.
Yeah. And to that point, that's a good perspective to have. But I'm around Bud Black. We'll talk Rockies in a second. I'm around Bud Black. Bud Black is an amazing baseball mind. I talked to Mark Shapiro, Toronto Blue Jays president. He's like, Bud Black was the last remaining piece for me to have my baseball development as he started to learn the front office when he was in Cleveland. I just saw AJ Hinch. AJ Hinch said, Bud Black is a huge, important person for my baseball development. Bud Black is a great baseball mind. But going back to Craig Breslow and pitchers talking to position players, they don't understand, like, a position player asking to be moved to a different spot positionally is a big deal. It's not like having a pitcher be a starter or pitch in the sixth inning or be a late inning reliever. Like, there's still some steps for a pitcher, but ultimately they're still pitching. We're talking about full on positional change, which isn't easy to do. And so when Devers said, you know, like, they didn't talk to me. That was the first thing he said in spring training. He was like, well, they didn't say anything. He was like caught off guard that they signed Alex Bregman. That is a communication breakdown. That's a systemic breakdown. You know, that's not on just Craig Breslow. That is a organizational breakdown. And, you know, you can't say it's lost in translation because there you have translators. Alex Cora speaks perfect Spanish. There's a lot here. I don't know if his agent got involved and messed this thing up too. There's just so many variables that to me, it's never black and white. But I think it was preventable with better communication.
So I think we have to go back to something you said about, all right, this needed to be communicated earlier. The point that I really wanted to get at is the timing. Because sure, you could say they could have made this decision as soon as last season ended and say, hey, you're moving to first base. But I would say that even once you sign Bregman and it's like, hey, dude, we just got to go to third baseman, it should become very apparent now where this is headed. What I didn't understand is why Casas needed to be the first baseman instead of Devers. I didn't understand going to the player who is going to be there for sure long term, which is Rafael Devers on this massive contract, and put him into DH, seemingly, you know, forcing him into that and forcing your organization into that spot. That is backing your whole your organization into a corner that seemed completely unnecessary. Whereas I don't understand why he wasn't just taking ground balls at first base, and maybe even you have a rotation between Casas and Devers at first and DH, and instead saying, put your glove away forever, you can understand why Devers now is like, well, what the hell? I thought I was done playing any defense, not to mention now you want me to learn it in the middle of the season. I think Alex Cora is a huge part of this too, because you just mentioned that could be part of the breakdown, but what is so compelling about this whole narrative, and this goes back to the offseason too, is there seems to be a lack of alignment just between Breslow and Cora. Cora has thus far stood up for Rafi, said, no, he is my DH. I'm not going to think about it. He even said before all this stuff came out from Rafi yesterday, he said, it would be unfair to ask him to do that. That seems to be a reflection of Cora being on the same page and understanding what his player wants. But how do you reconcile that when that does not appear to be how the general manager is viewing things?
That's a great question. A couple of things. When I think about players not wanting to do something that they're not going to do, right? I'll give you a Troy Tulowitzki example. Tulo said he'd retire before he ever not played shortstop, right? There were suggestions that he moved to third, save his body, right? That's what Alex Rodriguez did. Tulo was like, I'm not an A-Rod guy. I'm a Derek Jeter guy. Jeter stayed at shortstop the entire time. Tulo was not going to play third base. He was going to be a shortstop or retired. And that's exactly what happened. So there are certain players where, you know, if you tell them that you're going to go to a different spot, they're in their mind, they just don't want to do it. So having Devers as a DH, and he has this great relationship with David Ortiz, it took him a little bit of time, right? He got off to a horrendous start. And then I think part of that was just figuring out the routine of being a DH. And then he got it. He's been raking. The guy rakes.
Raking.
He's one of the best left-handed hitters in the sport. Like, he's a top five left-handed hitter in all of baseball. And when it's all said and done, Rafi Devers is probably going to be a borderline Hall of Famer because of the length of contract, the numbers he's going to put up. He's going to be close to 450.
Started early. Like, he's compiling some ridiculous stats, 100%.
Great player. So it's not a knock about him as a baseball player. Defensively, not a great player. But as an offensive player, unbelievable, right? Like, he's Yordan, he's Ohtani, right? As a DH, like, big left-handed, middle of the lineup type of bat. So what do you do if the manager and the front office are misaligned? That becomes a problem because the manager has to keep the room. If the manager says, you don't need your glove anymore, let's just focus on the DH, that's his word. He told him, He sat in an office with him and was like, listen, let's not worry about it this year. You're our DH. Just go hit, figure this thing out. Now you're asking the manager to go back on it, which that's part of like creating a chemistry and an environment of the team. And if you break that, Devers starts talking, right? Turns into this like negative cancer in the clubhouse. Well, what is Cora going to do here? Cora is principle based. He is going to stick it. If he thinks this is the best way to do it, he communicates it. And then that's what happens. So you can't come in from the front office and go, hey, we need him to come play first base. No, you can't do that. You've already said that I gave him my word. I cannot go back on that to this player specifically. And I'm not saying that one player is better than any other of the 26, but that player specifically, when you tell him, because there's a lot going on here, when you say you're just going to DH this year, you have to stay true to the word.
I also think it's relevant that Cora probably has more organizational juice, more say in baseball operations decisions than maybe any other manager in the sport, right? We know that became a problem with him and Chaim Bloom under the past regime. And I think that this situation does not shine brightly on Craig Breslow, the chief baseball officer with the Boston Red Sox. And one of my biggest issues with Breslow as a former player is that he's almost cosplaying a front office quant dork role. There was a moment in the Netflix documentary where he's like, I'm just like you. I'm a player. I'm not a robot. And then whenever he talks about baseball, it sounds like ChatGPT, right? And so I can understand how this got miscommunicated from Breslow down. Now, he's done a lot of good things, and I understand that. I think multiple things are true here, though, Spilly. Okay, I think that the Red Sox handled this very poorly, both communication-wise and in terms of not having Devers take reps at first base. But where the situation is at right now, Rafi Devers should go play first base. Okay, and I don't think that he is helped by the context in recent years of Aaron Judge being like, sure, I'll go play center field. Bryce Harper being like, sure, I'll go play first base. Jazz Chisholm, when the Yankees traded for him, the plan was for him to play second. Torres didn't want to move, and Jazz was like, yeah, sure, I'll play third, right? We have examples of Mookie Betts. Sure, I'll go play short, right? Like, we have these examples of players being willing to do it for the betterment of the team. That's what Devers should do. I understand that he's frustrated and he's pissed off, but I think he needs to swallow his pride and make that switch. Where do you fall on what should happen now?
So when it comes to like a pride thing, a team thing, especially with a player, like all personalities are going to be different. You're very specific with the guys that were willing to move spots. I gave you an example of somebody that wasn't willing to move. I think there's a lot of examples of players unwilling to move spots. You just don't hear about it. I'm with you. If it was communicated the entire time, like do whatever it takes to win. All right. You know, and you needed, in this case, Rafi probably needed to feel like he was the one that was coming up with the idea. Like he needed to have ownership of it. And in this case, he's had no ownership of anything. He's being forced. He got forced to first base. He's forced to DH. Now he's forced to, there's no ownership. So he doesn't want to do it. I got a 14-year-old son. He literally, if I ask him to do something, he'll tell me no. It has to be.
Yeah, but you're not paying your son $313 million.
It's not about the cost of, it's not about the cost of the contract. It does set a bad precedent within the clubhouse. It does. Like,
okay.
This,
that's what
this
I want to
ask. This guy's not going to do that.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if I'm a Red Sox player and I'm doing everything I can to win ball games for the team and the highest paid guy in the room is not going to go play first base, that's a problem, right? How do you go about handling that?
Yeah, well, and that's really the perspective that I really want to make sure we're getting from you here, because you know we're recording this on Friday morning, and the Red Sox are in Kansas City this weekend, and obviously they are going to be asked, the players, Cora is going to be asked about it, and we'll see how they choose to defer, how they choose to decide to address this. But I am curious, right? You put yourself in this situation, whether you have seen it before, like, what is the best way to handle this? Because it's not up to them. You know, it's not, you know, it's, you could go ask all these wrestlers, but they didn't ask to have the situation. This is obviously something very specifically between Devers and Cora and Breslow, et cetera, et cetera. But they're part of this story too. So I'm curious where you think this could go.
So I just watched the Tigers play. Tigers play arguably the best brand of team baseball in the entire sport. They pinch hit, guys are swapping out different spots, yep. different spots in the lineup, you know, right? AJ has a leadoff hitter that gets pinch hit for in the fifth inning if there's a lefty coming in. Multiple, you know, positional changes. That took time. It wasn't overnight. That took time to get it to get the buy-in for the bullpen, took time for the offensive group. You know, we've seen teams try to do these platoons and it doesn't always work. It takes time. Getting a brand of baseball that is team first is, it takes time, right? Like, it's not just something you snap your finger like, hey, play for the team. So, you know, it's the bodies in the room. I think they got the great bodies in the room with Boston because I think Bregman is that guy that's like, hey, we'll do whatever it takes to win. Part of it is some bad habits from Devers from however the clubhouse was before. I still think it's really communicated poorly to begin with. And, you know, had the narrative have been for Devers to, hey, we're going to move you off of third. We're going to figure out a way to get you comfortable wherever you want to play, first or DH. You can like, we want you to work on it. This is why. It makes our whole team better. It could have led to this clubhouse sentiment where you now don't have a player that's not willing to do something, and it reflects poorly on his teammates, reflects poorly on the organization, because it's like, wait, this guy doesn't even want to move positions? What the hell? But you have to backdate it. You have to go back and see how we got here. That's why it's so complicated. It's because the last thing you want to do, man, like, it's the worst. I've had this. Where your teammates start talking behind your back like he's some, like, prima donna, like he's some, like, D-bag, doesn't want to do anything for his team.
Which is not.
That's probably the last thing. But it's now the optics of it. And it looks really poorly on Devers, right? Like,
yeah.
And it shouldn't be on him. It shouldn't be on him. That's my point, is this, it should never have gotten here.
Right. Yeah. And so we will see. This story is obviously not over. I don't know. And by the way, there's so many other moving pieces to this Red Sox roster that make this all the more interesting, whether it's Yoshida, whether it's where's Roman Anthony. Like, there's so many parts of it, like, which makes, I understand it is a difficult job for Craig Breslow. Some of that was foreseeable and could have constructed the roster differently or made some other decisions. But at the same time, it's, dude, you know, where you're at right now is, it's very apparent that the best option is for Devers to play first. So,
like, forget the communication thing. You're going to clog your DH spot up for the next 10 years as you have a number of top prospects matriculating to the big leagues and you want to be able, like, that's what doesn't make sense to me, right? Is like, obviously Devers is an amazing hitter whose bat is good enough to play at DH. Like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that your organization is in a spot where you need that place to get guys in. And it's just bizarre that they couldn't foresee that at all. The last thing, Jordan, we talked about this before we started recording, is Alex Cora calling the bluff. If Alex Cora writes Devers 1B on the lineup card and, like, hands it in, like, what happens? Like
who knows?
Like what? He's not going to do that.
It's a more interesting, right? It sure doesn't seem like it, because it doesn't sound like Cora wants to do that, or he still seems to be publicly more on Devers' side so far. But yeah, I don't know what happens. I don't know, because
I mean, look, first base. You guys, I know you like love defensive first baseman. So do I. Because if you think about defensively first base, it's often overlooked, the importance of a defensive first baseman. Mm-hmm. If you follow, like, good defensive first baseman, other players in the infield win gold gloves. Matt Olson, Paul Goldschmidt, Todd Helton, like the guys that I've been around that I've watched consistently, those guys, wherever they play good quality defense, there's a gold glove that goes with it for somebody else. So last year, defensively for the Red Sox, you go to the first half of the season, they were atrocious defensively in the infield, which is what drove Alex Cora crazy. They were brutal. There's a reason why Nick Pivetta had an ERA that was so high. People are like, dude, what the heck's up? Nick Pivetta had the worst defense behind him ever. So to move Devers to first base, and if he's a below average defender, that weighs on the infield defense, which takes down your team ERA, which starts dinging you for like extra outs, extra runs being scored. You become a worse team. You can't just like shove Jake to first base and like, hey, he can do it. Like, no, the baseball.
Tell him, Wash.
Baseball realizes that like a first baseman is as important as a center fielder, as a shortstop, as a catcher. Like, if I'm thinking about premium positions defensively, first base is near the top of my list.
And this is the thing. The premise that Devers could become a decent first baseman is realistic. The premise that he could do it right now is much harder. And that is why it's just like, should have been doing it in spring. Really not. Like, that's the most obvious first point for all of this that I think does fall on the Red Sox. Now, again, there are so many Devers quotes that are so specifically interesting that we could get into, but I do want to move on because this is an evolving story. I'm sure we will talk about it in some other form next week as we get more reaction from the Red Sox. So the one other topic we definitely wanted to hit with you, Spilly, which you referenced earlier, is the Rockies. And obviously, it has been a historically challenging start for this team. You are on the Rockies broadcast, played for Colorado for several seasons. You understand this team, you understand this organization, and we're just going to keep it pretty broad. We're not going to do the full deep dive right now, obviously. But I think, you know, seeing Kyle Freeland's kind of reaction yesterday, and that really is why the perspective that I want from you in particular, because one of the things about the Rockies is, and this has been to their detriment to some degree for sure, but there are a lot of people there that have been there for a long time. And I think Kyle Freeland is a perfect example of that. Someone who has won in Colorado. You know, there are some of the players on this team that have been to the postseason and feel like they can be on a good team. But now here they are in a very, very difficult situation. And I guess as someone who also, you know, played your whole career in Colorado and understands this organization, like where are we at and is there a path forward? Maybe not in the short term, but can you kind of speak to what Kyle Freeland is kind of showing? Those
I have no problem talking about Rocky. I actually do a Rockies podcast and I'm pretty blunt when it comes to what's going on. So I want to read you a couple little things that this was Rocky's post-game game notes, which is kind of fun. And we'll get into Kyle for a second. So it says the Rockies were swept in a doubleheader for the second time this year. Royals did it April 24th. They were outscored 21-3, a minus 18 run differential in a doubleheader sweep in franchise history. It's the 31 losses through the first 37 decisions are tied with the 1988 Orioles for the most in the modern era. The stats are telling you this is historically bad. 6-31. Rocky's PR department's fantastic. They have just been putting down the numbers. There's like,
it's telling you what's happening.
This is not personal, right? These are the numbers. A team starting pitcher's ERA close to a 7. You're not going to win baseball games there. One of the highest chase percentages in the league for hitters. One of the highest strikeout percentages in the league for hitters. At the bottom of defensive efficiency. There isn't one aspect right now other than the bullpen, which, hey, I'll give you some silver lining. Since April 9th, listen to this one. The Tigers and the Rockies are the two best bullpens in baseball. And then it's like,
see, I said this about the Nats. I was like, if the Nats had the Rockies bullpen, they wouldn't be in the playoffs.
Yeah. I mean, the Rockies bullpen's been good. The Zach Agnos kid, great story.
They lost his
father in 2021. He's great. Seth Halverson, I call him gas because he throws hard as heck. Angel Chivier, his dad played with me in the minor leagues. Like, there's some arms here. There's some arm talent, but they're in the toughest division in baseball. They are going to lose north of 122 games. I mean, there's no end in sight right now. And yesterday, Kyle was embarrassed. that's what happened. A defensive miscue, you know, a ball hit to Alan Trejo. He was kind of blinded by the base runner error, led to this just horrible, horrible result. So Kyle was broken, man. This is broken Kyle Freeland, a kid from Denver. He's embarrassed. Here's the last little nugget. Look, this is from yesterday's game notes. 26 unearned runs allowed for the Rockies. 26. That's the most in baseball.
But the thing I want to get at with Kyle, again, is just that thing I refer to, is that perspective. Because it's easy for a lot of people outside of this to be like, oh, they're doomed forever. But I still say, like, they made the play. They've won a playoff game more recently than teams X, Y, Z, and, like, whatever. And especially if you're Kyle Freeland or you're Ryan McMahon or you're Antonio Senzatella and you've been in the organization for 10 years and you feel like there is, like, why is this bad? That's what's really, and that's why Freeland is the perfect person to kind of speak to that. Because these other young players, you know, whether they're good enough or not, they're just doing their best. They're just trying to focus on being in the big leagues and whatever that means to them. But you can tell it just weighs so much more on someone who has actually succeeded as a Rocky. And that's what was so kind of heartbreaking to see from
you. Yeah. And I think part of the reason why it's also frustrating is he is going back to, and I love saying this about the Dodgers, you know, the Dodgers have made the division better. Like what the Dodgers have done organizationally, you know, you can say whatever you want about how much they spend on payroll. Okay, like that's the lowest hanging fruit. Do your research, right? What the Dodgers have done is they hire the best people in the business, analytics department, medical fields, hitting, coaching. They have more coaches in the minor leagues than any other organization. There are some teams out there where if you think about the player development and that side of the ledger, you got to throw the Brewers up there because they spend a bunch on that side. Guardians spend a ton on that side. There's some teams, the Tampa Bay Rays,
right? The Rays have like 1,000 scouts, you know.
I mean,
they spend all their money on infrastructure.
Whatever to get that last little drop of juice to see something from a player in another organization that you can bring him over and go, hey, we really like this guy's high angled arm slot. We think that this pairs really nicely with if we increase his curveball usage. That's what teams are doing. And so, like, the Diamondbacks have gotten better because of the Dodgers. The Giants have gotten better. Like, I know Buster probably will never give Farhan credit for what he has right now, but Farhan deserves some credit. And where did he come from? So, like, the Padres have gotten better. Like, all these different organizations have gotten better because of the Dodgers. The one team that hasn't in that division is the Rockies. They have not upped their arms race in the same way that the Dodgers or the Padres or any of these other teams have. They've just stayed behind the times. And so this was predictable. We could see this coming. You could see that the changes weren't happening and that the issues with the team were consistent. And it wasn't gonna stop. So that's why we're here.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can't, it's easy to say, hey, you know, there have been some unfortunate injuries. Oh, there's been some bad luck. You don't go 6-31 because of just that. This is an institutional issue. They are stuck in 2015, 2016 era of baseball. And as the sport has moved forward, they have stayed static. And as that gap increases and increases, we're now in a point where we're seeing, you know, the fruits of that, for lack of a better term. And I don't see a path forward. And that, I think, is to me the most dispiriting thing is to catch up, you have to do what the Marlins are doing right now or what the Orioles did under Elias, which is setting up completely new infrastructure from the bottom up. And that takes a long time. And so I wish I could leave Rockies fans with a more hopeful tone. I just don't have right now.
It's a beautiful stadium. They're fun guys.
Good beer.
For.
Yeah.
Blue Moon. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I've suggested this as, like, you know, the one thing that we've seen other organizations do that doesn't infiltrate, you know, some of the Rockies' thought process is you can hire a third party. you can do a third party audit of the organization from somebody that you trust, right? Thad Levine is no longer the president of baseball operations with the Minnesota Twins. He started with the Rockies. You want to have him audit the organization and go like, look, this is what you're missing out on. Good idea. The Cardinals did this with Chaim Bloom, and now Chaim's taking over for John Mozeliak. You know, there are groups out there that can audit your organization. I have a great suggestion for one. Remember that guy that created the Houston Astros and he's been shot out into the sun out of spite? Jeff Luhnow? I would sell my soul to the devil right now to have him come in and audit the organization. It has to be something like that. A little bit drastic. I don't care. Like, you know, AJ Hinch paid his penance. Alex Cora paid his penance. I feel bad for Carlos Beltran. But Jeff Luhnow was the architect behind what happened with the Astros. And he's doing Premier League stuff. Like, sure. That you can hire that as a third party.
And his boys are about to get relegated. His team that he owns is about to get relegated from La Liga into Division Two, so it could be the best.
Oh, maybe it's a good time.
Come back to big leagues. Yeah, we missed you.
Here's the thing. There's a lot of people, highly qualified, that I'm sure would like to lend a helping hand. And we will see if that ever happens anytime soon. But for now, Spilly, we appreciate your perspective on Mr. Devers and on those Rockies of Colorado. You can watch Spilly on Apple TV Plus Friday Night Baseball. I believe you got the Nats and Cardinals tonight, but I've seen you all around the country, so definitely check that out. But otherwise, thank you, Mr. Spielborgs. I think this was pretty fun.
Adios, muchachos.
And welcome back to this absolutely stiznacked episode of Baseball Barbacast. We have discussed Ball Pope. We have discussed Rafi Devers. And now we will discuss the Pittsburgh Pirates axing their manager, Derek Shelton. They have relieved him of his duties. They have appointed bench coach Don Kelly, a Pittsburgh native, as the manager, not the interim manager, the manager for the remainder of the season. This is our first firing of 2025. It is the earliest into a season that a manager has been fired since 2018. Usually these midseason firings happen a little bit later, but the Pirates, the 12-26 Pirates, felt it was time to make a change. Jordan, what were your first thoughts when you heard that the Pirates, a team we have forbade ourselves from talking about on this podcast, a rule we are now breaking? What was your first thought when you heard they let Shelton go?
Yeah, that's kind of what happens when you are this bad for this long. So, you know, we just had a conversation about hitting coaches kind of being the more obvious kind of first place to turn. And in Pittsburgh's case, where offense has been the issue, maybe you could say, oh, well, you got to get rid of all the hitting coaches and do it, whatever. Derek Shelton has overseen a team that certainly this year has now gone backwards. Now, you wrote about this for Yahoo, and I think you gave this some more thorough thought. And again, my intro here makes it sound like it's all Derek Shelton's fault. Obviously, it is not. However, if you just look at the trajectory and where situations usually end up with managers being fired, when you have a team that has this long of a postseason drought, a team that won 76 games each of the last 2 years, and it was like, okay, come on, can we take a step forward? And so far this year have seemingly taken an even bigger step backward. Whether or not that's Derek Shelton's fault, we are at the point now where it's like he might not be the guy. Whether that's true or not, it certainly did not surprise me in the absolute slightest.
I want to hop in now because you say that he might not be the guy. There is no guy. There is no guy here. The greatest manager in baseball history, whoever you think that is, if you gave that manager, these Pittsburgh Pirates, this roster, they would still be bad. They might be a couple games better, maybe, but the manager can only do so much. You can only cook dinner with what's in the cupboard. And there is an element of like putting lipstick on the pig. The players aren't good enough. It's that simple. And I don't think that firing Shelton is going to fix anything. I don't think that keeping Shelton would have fixed anything. I understand the desire to send a message to the fan base that, hey, we understand as an organization the way that we've been playing is not good enough. But it only is a half measure. Firing general manager Ben Cherington, in my opinion, would only be something of a half measure, because the organization is significantly hamstrung by the amount that this ownership group is willing to spend. Now, Cherington, the GM, in my opinion, bears more blame than Shelton does. You can build a competitive roster within a restrictive budget. Teams have done that before. It is much harder to do than it is to build a competitive roster with $130 million compared to $80 or whatever. But the teams simply have not been good enough. And I like Derek Shelton. I think he is a smart baseball person. I am happy for Derek Shelton that he no longer needs to think about the Pittsburgh Pirates or stress about who's going to be in the lineup or answer questions for why this front office and ownership group isn't spending money. He wasn't the solution, maybe. He certainly was not the problem.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on all that. And I think that what makes this situation different than some of the other managerial changes that we've had recently is, again, you have to think about why you end up doing this instead of firing a GM. And firing a GM feels like a much more dramatic move, because then you feel like the direction of everything, it's a much bigger statement, especially when you're from the ownership standpoint, where it's like, especially when you've already lost this many years in a row, firing the GM makes you feel like you're starting over in so many big ways that is, I think, scary for most ownership situations. Whereas firing a manager, firing a hitting coach makes it feel like, okay, maybe we can spark something. Again, a lot of this is nonsensical because I totally agree with you. The roster isn't good enough, and that's why maybe you could blame Cherington even more. But when you're in a situation this bad, like, this is just kind of normally what ends up happening. But it's very different than the conversation we're having about the Rangers or even like the Mariners last year, where it's like, there is talent here and we're underperforming. That's not the conversation. It's just like, they're not good. And you feel like you need to do something because they've been bad for a long time and the same people have been in charge. And so it's that simple, because that is, and that's why it's not surprising that this is how it ends. But it is still disappointing for him because, like I said, like, yeah, of course it's not his thing, but they are really bad right now. They've lost seven in a row. They're 12-26. They're like, they're going backwards. And maybe that is Cherington's fault. That's fine. But when you have when you've missed the postseason this many times in a row, and you feel like you maybe were starting to build something on the mound with Skeens, with Jared Jones, with Bubba Chandler coming, all those things, you don't want to change. Again, you can apply this to some other situations with firings where it's like, no, we still believe in the big picture stuff, which you could push back and say, no, I do not do that. But when you've already missed the playoffs this many years in a row, firing the GM, it makes it harder to feel like, oh, now we're sudden, that is the move that's going to make us go forward faster. But also, to your point, it doesn't matter, because if you're giving the GM $20 million to work with every year, then it doesn't make a difference.
In no way do I believe in anything going on in Pirates land right now. There are people who work there that we really like, that I think are smart, and they have told me they believe in various aspects of the organization, and they think that things will get better, and they, you know, believe in player X improving. And I want to believe those people, but at a certain point, you just have to look at the results.
Yeah.
You have to look at the results. Ben Cherington and his group have been there since the end of 2019, I believe, like the offseason of 19 and into 20. That is enough time to judge a group. And there has not been enough progress. And the reputation of this front office around baseball is not one where people say, hey, the Pirates, they're figuring it out. They're getting better.
Yeah.
That is not what I hear. And because of that, I find it hard to blame Shelton, especially in a day and age where the manager has less of an impact on baseball operations decisions, usually, in most organizations, than ever before. That's all. That's the thought. Derek Shelton, good job, good effort, valiantly lived tenure.
And by the way,
Pittsburgh.
I would just say too, like Don Kelly, Ben Cherington saying that his manager title is, quote, permanent for 2025.
It's not like what that
okay.
Means.
So yeah, but again, that's the thing. Maybe it's interim, maybe it's not. I don't. Charrington, who knows if he is going to still be in charge at this time next year? There could be more changes coming. It's last disappointing. Take. And the other thing too is it's like you can keep saying they're not getting it, they're not using any money. There are other teams that spend no money and they win a whole lot more than the Pirates. So at some point, you have to put some of it on the people who are making the decisions with the limited resources.
Also, Don Kelly might be a nice guy. Not a new voice.
Not at all. No. That's,
if you want to bring in Buck Showalter or Dusty Baker to like shake things up, sure. But this is just
Brett Boone.
Not a new voice. Brett Boone. He knows ball.
All right. Let's
who knows
let's
more ball, Brett Boone or the Pope? The Pope.
Has the Pope ever had a podcast? I don't know. Let's go to the good, the bad, the ugly, our favorite time of the week. Something good, something bad, something ugly from the week that was, or in my case, the week ahead. Whoa. I'm so excited for my ugly. But Jake, why don't you start us off with something good?
What is good? The Cubs are promoting pitching prospect Cade Horton. He will start this weekend for the Pope's least favorite team, presumably.
Cade Horton, that's interesting. Does he hate the Cubs or does he not like the Cubs as much as the White Sox?
Well, I would imagine if the Pope were to rank all 30 teams, the Cubs would be at the bottom. Anyway,
sure.
Cade Horton, the team's top pitching prospect, very exciting pitcher, fascinating amateur developmental journey where he had Tommy John and came back very late in his, I believe, his sophomore year. And like pitched three times down the stretch for an Oklahoma team that made the World Series and was amazing enough that he jumped all the way into the top 10 of the draft. I was right behind home plate for all of his Omaha start and it was electrifying. I'll never forget that experience of seeing him carve. I'm excited to see what he can do in the big leagues. Jordan, you can kind of give people a better sense of where he's at right now, prospect status wise.
Yeah, I mean, again, like you said, it was a very unusual journey. I mean, he was a famous high schooler who was very talented, but it just didn't come together until the best possible time for it to come together, which is like in the postseason and in Omaha in front of a bunch of scouts. And so because that sample size of him being so good was so small, once he got into pro ball, you didn't really know what to expect because it was like, all right, what's the workload going to look like? And then his first year of pro ball in 2023, he was fantastic. Last year was a little bit more of a step back. He was injured. He only made 9 starts. But it seems like he's kind of gotten back on track this year, has gone out in AAA and has looked tremendous. He's still only 23, turns 24 in August. And the Cubs obviously have some pitching questions right now, more so in the bullpen. But with, Shota Imanaga having an injury, we know, with Justin Steele being out, we knew Cade Horton was going to have to come up at some point. And now we're going to see what it looks like. When his velo is on, it is a damn good fastball and damn good slider. And he's still, he's still kind of figuring out what he has. It sounds like he's going to start on Saturday against the Mets. And it'll be interesting to see if this is a temporary solution for the Cubs or if he can stick for the long haul. He's a very, very talented pitcher. So if he can stay healthy, I think he can help them in a big way.
Go ahead. What's your good?
My good is the Kansas City Royals. What? The Royals just mopped the Pope's White Sox. Good thing he was distracted becoming the Pope. Didn't have to watch them get embarrassed in Kansas City during this week as the Royals with the swift midweek mop. But no, I'm not giving them just a good because they mopped the White Sox. They have won 15 of their last 17 games. Now, you could point out that those games are against the Rockies and at the Rays and at the Orioles and the Astros. Are the Astros good, bad, ugly? I don't know.
Who knows?
But 15 of 17 against anybody at any point is definitively good. And while I still don't really think this offense is anything special, Bobby Witt Jr. is absolutely unbelievable. And I think that... I think that now they're right back in it, and the AL Central is now looking as spicy as it was last year. So as well as the Tigers have played, they have not opened as big of a gap as you would expect, and part of that is because of how well the Royals and Guardians and now Twins have been playing. So there you go, Royals, giving you some good.
My bad is a lack of technological innovation from a member of the baseball media community. Did you see this tweet?
All right. Oh, I think I did.
Okay. John Heyman. John Heyman, a columnist over at New York Post. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know John Heyman. He's like one of the top five news breakers in the industry. He tweeted the following thing last night. Wanted to thank at Giancarlo818, that is Giancarlo Stanton, who showed me how to use voice memo on my phone last night. Okay, I'm going to peel the curtain back here. In the baseball locker room and scrums when you're doing an interview, I would say about 70% of reporters just use the voice memo app on their phone to do that recording. Some will use a transcription service that you can record directly on, whether that's Otter or something else. Some will use recorders, like high-end kind of throwback style recorders that have better audio quality and plug it into their computer. I like to use my phone, used to use a recorder. Now I prefer my phone. One person in the industry does something different, and that's John Heyman. I have seen this many times. John Heyman, before yesterday, I presume, would open up the video app on his phone, press record on video, and then just like hold the phone out and take a video of nothing and then use the audio of that video to transcribe. I have seen John, not trying to put him on the blast, he put himself on blast. I have seen John do this many times before. And every time I thought to myself, he must be doing this for a reason, right? It can't be that he doesn't know how to use the voice memo app. That can't be possible. Turns out it is. And I love that of all people in the universe, Giancarlo Stanton pulled John aside yesterday and said, what are you doing here?
Why? Like, he was like, dude, there's a better way. That is incredible. That does actually say a lot about Big G. Mad respect.
Big respect for Big G.
Big respect. To be like, John, let me help you out.
I got you.
That is incredible. So it's so funny because before you told this story, I saw the tweet and in my head, I was like, is he talking about like sending voice memos like over text, right? Because that's another thing that you can do.
Sure.
Where it's like, oh, like instead of writing out a text, like I'm just going to record myself talking for 20 seconds. I do this sometimes if I'm too lazy and I just want to like rant into my phone to send
when
it to someone.
In the Dominican, when I was in the Dominican, that was like the number one mode of communication.
Oh, absolutely. Over WhatsApp. Yeah, people are just sending you know, voice memos to each other nonstop.
Like when, you remember
texting.
When we went to Carlos Gomez's house?
I of course.
And Carlos Gomez was just sending me WhatsApp audio recordings of like where his house was. And he was like saying the address of his house on a WhatsApp. Exactly. And I was like, is that
So when I saw this tweet from John, I was like, oh, like that's kind of weird that. Like, I was like, is he flexing that, like, he's texting with Giancarlo? I was like, what is this? But instead, it is exactly what you described with the context that is absolutely tremendous.
Isn't that great?
That is so funny. And if anything, respect to John Heyman for doing his job as, you know, well, with this being the process for so long. I mean, it's absolutely wild. So... man, watch out. Now that he's learned the voice memos, he's going to be tough to stop.
Rosenthal passing, take a seat.
Sweating. Whoo boy. Okay. Holy crap. That's incredible. All right. My bad this week. Is the Orioles trading for the other Luis Castillo? Now, this is not Luis Castillo, the other Luis Castillo's fault. Luis F. Castillo, notably born on March 10th, just like me. So shout out to him. He had kind of made a couple appearances for the Mariners. He's just like a fringe 5-6 starter that has bounced around a few orgs. The Orioles obviously need pitching depth. But for the Orioles to drop a press release saying they've acquired Luis Castillo like very late on one of the nights earlier this week. And people being like, oh my God, like, did the Orioles actually like make a move here? Did they actually swing a deal for a big time starting pitcher who they were rumored to have maybe interest in over the offseason? Like, no. This is another guy named Luis Castillo. is just one of the great sequences of all time. And I wish the other Luis Castillo much luck, and maybe at some point they will acquire the good Luis Castillo. But for now, they are stuck with the one that people don't know who he is. So that's bad, and so are the Orioles, who got swept by the Twins. What's Ugla?
My Ugla is a tweet.
All right.
A tweet from former Yankees, Angels, Giants, Red Sox first baseman JT Snow.
Okay.
Did you see this?
I don't think so.
JT Snow, good player. 11 wins above replacement over 16 years. 105 would have guessed plus
it was
career.
Would have guessed it was more than that. All right, JT Snow.
His defense graded out way lower than I think the reputation was. But that's not why it's Ugla.
Yeah, six-time Gold Glover.
Yeah. What's so, Ugla?
Okay. Yeah.
Is a tweet, a since deleted tweet, and here's what it says.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Hey Trump.
Oh boy, here we go.
100% tariff on movies made outside America? Why don't you shut the hell up and stay out of the movie business? What a flipping joke. My son is the best film student at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, and now he has to deal with this. These are good kids. And then under that, he tweeted, and by the way, Donald Trump cheats at golf. I know that for a fact. The most honorable game, and you cheat, and you couldn't pay me to buy a Tesla.
Wow, he covered a lot of ground. So he used every character that we probably don't want to have on this godforsaken website. This is an impressively efficient display of fury from JT Snow.
Here's the best part of this is the claim. My son is the best film student at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. JT Snow Jr. Maybe JT Snow Jr. is the best film student at Loyola Marymount University. I'll take the under on that, just from an odds perspective. I don't know
how many film students there are, but sure, okay.
I mean, it's refute that. LA, there's probably a lot. Like, I'll just take field, is all I'm saying. Like, JT Snow Jr. versus the field, I'll take the field. just in the tweet, like, arguing against movie tariffs, just gassing up your son's filmmaking ability
True.
Is so good.
I think my favorite part is like he writes the first part of the tweet, right? Pissed about the tariffs, standing up for his kid. Love that. And he's like, You know what? I'm not done. Just so you know. This guy cheats at golf. yeah, right. I mean, you know what? Our president is impacting people in ways that, you know, you never quite expect. But
JT Snow, the 11th liberal-minded baseball player. Congratulations.
I still kind of doubt that. but hey, it's impacting his son's filmmaking, and he doesn't like the most honorable game being cheated. That's fine.
Also, you played baseball.
Baseball, not the most
professionally, not honorable. That's really what I want to know. Why does JT Snow, he's anti-ball?
JT Snow played during a time that was, I think, less honorable than it maybe is now. So,
I need Bobby Wagner's
team that
take on this former producer anyway. Bobby Wagner, who produces the Big Picture over at The Ringer, movie guy. Maybe JT Snow Jr. is like the top film prospect. He's like, you know, the Roman Anthony
but,
of
hey
pictures.
And we might never find out because these tariffs, man. He's squashing his hopes and dreams in the filmmaking community. All right, my Ugla is the upcoming NAIA baseball tournament.
Oh, what's the NAIA?
The NCAA. For those, of course, that's the most college sports is under the NCAA. There is an additional kind of organization, how shall we say it, association of schools, many of which you've never heard of, that is outside the NCAA that has sports at different levels. NAIA baseball is a very interesting world.
National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics.
There you go. It is a 46-team tournament. Don't know why it's 46 teams. Don't care. There are three things about this upcoming tournament that you have to know about. All right?
I know none of them, so I'm excited.
That's why I'm so excited, okay? Number one, there is a team that is 51-0 going into the tournament. LSU Shreveport is 51-0, the greatest record ever assembled by, I believe, any college baseball team, for now, is 51-0 going into this tournament. So can they go all the way? Can they run the table?
51-0.
That's the first thing to know. Okay, 51-0. They've outscored their opponents like 580-100. Like, it's outrageous. Good program historically. I don't believe they've ever won a championship. So,
feels like LSU this is the year.
You would hope. So that was my gateway into the NAIA tournament for this year, okay?
They have wins of 37-0, 42-4.
Okay.
They have there's only like 3-1 run wins on here too. So they're really just smoking people.
So that's the first thing. That is really what caught my attention for this tournament coming up is 51-0 LSU Shreveport. Okay. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. Pilots, keep an eye on the Pilots. Next up, we have a player for the University of the Cumberlands in Kentucky. His name is Charlie Muniz. Okay. He is a catcher. And Charlie Muniz has 111 career home runs in 4 years at the University of the Cumberlands. That is the most ever hit by a college baseball player at any level. All right. And he is just, this is it. This is it. And by the way, not only does he have 111 home runs in four seasons at the Cumberlands, he has another 21 home runs at 2 years of junior college before that. Okay, so this is year six of college baseball for Charlie Muniz from Puerto Rico, one of the great power hitters in the history of any level of college baseball. Great. Cumberland's very good team. We'll see what he can do. Okay?
Wow, keep an eye on homers. Big Charlie Muniz. A lot of long balls for Chuck.
That's a lot of home runs. Okay? But the last one, this is my favorite one. Okay? There is a regional being hosted that features three teams that are leading all of NAIA in stolen bases. Okay, so that had to have been on purpose, that the committee was like, this is going to be fun. We're just going to put these three teams in together, okay? So that in and of itself is great. But you need to understand the magnitude of this, okay? Georgia Gwinnett College, I do believe they have won a national championship at some point. This is a great program. They are the nation's leader in stolen bases, Jake. They have played 53 games this season. All right. They are 49-4. So not 51-0. So, you know, they're no LSU Shreveport. How many stolen bases do you think Georgia Gwinnett has this year in 53 games?
So I just pulled it up. The number is 344.
This is, you are the worst. I can't believe you spoil these things for yourselves as we're talking. It's a real bummer. But yes, that is the number. 344 steals in 53 games. So that's like six a game. This team is spectacular. And will this continue into the postseason against other teams that like to run all the time? Hopefully. But anyway, keep those in mind. Charlie Muniz. Climbing the just hit more homers. LSU Shreveport going for the undefeated season. Georgia Gwinnett, can they steal another? Can they get to 400 stolen bases in the postseason?
I'm all in on the LSU Pirates. The LSU Pilots, excuse me. They're great because the logo is just the LSU logo with an S at the end.
It's great.
It just looks like too, LSU's. It's
like, there's no, like, my understanding is like, Actually, is there any association? Like, is it considered a satellite school? Maybe to some degree? I don't know. Either way, they obviously do not compete in the NCAA. So that's what matters. All right, there you go. I don't know which of those three things are UGLA, a guy with 135 collegiate home runs over 6 years, or a team with 350 stolen bases, or a team that's 51-0. What's the most UGLA? I don't know. I believe the tournament starts on Monday. So keep an eye on that. That's it. We're done. We did a podcast. This was so much fun. Thank you to Ryan Spielbergs for joining us. Oh, Jake just found something crazy. Do you want to share with the class, or do you want to end the podcast?
I'll share with the class. I'm just poking around the LSU Shreveport baseball website. Mm-hmm. And under it says fan zone.
Oh,
you know, campus map, directions, photo gallery. The River Monster.
Okay, what do I need to know?
Just clicked on the River Monster, and their mascot at LSU Shreveport looks, I would just describe, it looks kind of like a giant booger.
Wait, but they're the pilots. What about, they don't have a pilot?
Nope. It looks like a huge furry booger.
All right. Well, that is as that. There we go. We have really arrived at UGLA. Oh, my gosh. The story of the River Monster. You know what? I'm not going to do this on the podcast. You guys can go read it for yourself, but you are right. This is very, very, very strange, and I don't understand why it's not just the pilot. Anyway, on that note, thank you all for listening to this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to the Pope for being a White Sox fan. Thank you to Ryan Spielborgs for joining us. Thank you to Rafael Devers for speaking your mind. Thank you to TJ Brassel for producing. And thank you, Jake Mintz, for doing this podcast with me. We will be back next week. Everyone have a wonderful weekend. Goodbye.